Hello. Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Deborah Adianju, a member of the Food Matters Forum at the club and the program chair for tonight. We're also welcoming our listening audience at this time, and we invite everyone to come and find us at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Ms. Bianca Bosker. She's the author of the newly published book, Cork Dork, A Wine-Fueled Adventure Among the Obsessive Sommeliers, Big Bottle Hunters, and Rogue Scientists Who Taught Me to Live for Taste. Prior to writing Cork Dork, Bianca was a tech journalist and editor for the Huffington Post in New York City. She's also a trained sommelier, and she holds her certified sommelier designation from the Court of Master Sommeliers. Please join me in welcoming Bianca Bosker.
Thank you. Yes, I will hold this. I feel like I should be running for office up here. This is amazing. So before I was the tech editor out of New York, I was actually living here in San Francisco, just a couple of blocks away. And I have to say that it is such a pleasure to be back, and also thank you. Thank you for being here. It's, you know, I write to be read. And I'm just so appreciative that you're here to listen to my story and make time to do that. So thank you. Though I will also say that as someone, you know, as a writer, you also spend quite a lot of time by yourself, and not used to being around quite this many actual other human beings, so I apologize if I'm a little bit nervous. But the good news is you guys all hopefully have some glasses of wine, and so you're going to be in a great mood and think I'm brilliant. So I want to start with a confession, which is the last thing in the world that I expected to write was a book about wine. There are people who spend their Saturday nights agonizing over the choice between wine from Burgundy and Bordeaux. I would spend my Saturday nights agonizing over the choice between wine from a bottle and a box, which is to say that I was in no way a wine connoisseur. And that actually didn't bother me that much until I discovered this world of Cork Dorks. And Cork Dork is not just the name of a book. It's the restaurant industry term for the most obsessed, passionate, and knowledgeable enophiles in their midst. And, you know, every wine lover, and I now could count myself, you know, this is, I think, not too much of a spoiler, but I would now consider myself a wine lover, has their wine epiphany. And normally, this moment happens while drinking very expensive wine in a very beautiful place. You know, you're swirling your Cabernet Sauvignon overlooking the hills of Napa Valley and, you know, staring into your lover's eyes, and you decide that this stuff is actually pretty good. My wine epiphany happened at a computer screen, and I wasn't actually even drinking wine. I was watching other people drink wine. And this was actually quite appropriate, because at that time in my life, I was doing most things via screens. As she mentioned, I was then the tech editor at the Huffington Post, which meant that my life was, you know, you guys live in San Francisco. You know, it's like I was, my people were Soylent people. You know, we believed that bodies should be abstracted, that virtual reality, you know, was really the future. And it started because I had happened to be dragged out to dinner. I'm a bit of an indoor kid. And I happened to be dragged out to dinner, and the sommelier mentioned that he was preparing for something called the Best Sommelier in the World competition. And my reaction to that was, no effing way. Like, you pour wine, you open it, you're done. Like, what could possibly be judged there? And that sent me on, you know, this deep internet hole, and I essentially got addicted on binge-watching YouTube videos of this Best Sommelier in the World competition that I can only describe as the Westminster Dog Show with booze. And, you know, these people put themselves, for what was ostensibly a beverage of pleasure, put themselves through a stunning amount of pain. You know, they hired voice coaches to modulate their voices into a pleasing baritone for their guests. They hired, they took dancing classes to be able to move more gracefully across the floor. They licked rocks to train their palates. They divorced spouses to spend more time studying, vineyard types and regions and all of these things. And I've written about many things, in my course as a journalist, but one through line is that I've always been obsessed with obsession. And since no one does mania like these wine lovers, I was hooked. But it also took on a more personal note, which is, as I mentioned, at this point, I was working in tech, and it was an incredible time. I mean, finally, it was this thing that was merging into this broader cultural story that everyone cared about. But this world of Quirk Dorks made me cognizant of just how sterile my life was. I actually had made someone do a story called How to Take a Vacation on Google Street View, if that gives you some idea of just the perverted brain state that I was in at the time. And I realized, I just got fixated on this question of what was I missing, not just in a glass of wine, but in life. I was living this life of sensory deprivation. They were living this life of sensory cultivation. Could I do what they did? And critically, as someone who had never felt her spirit moved by a glass of grape juice, I wanted to know what was the big deal about wine. And then I made a choice that was not advised by all of the people that loved me. And I'm just going to read a little bit from the beginning to give you a sense of what that transition was like. When you inform your friends and relatives that you have left your stable job as a journalist to stay home and taste wines, you will begin to get concerned phone calls. You say, "I'm going to hone my senses and find out what the big deal is about wine." They hear, "I'm quitting my job to drink all day and improve my chances of ending up homeless." I told them there was nothing to worry about. I was going to get a job in the wine industry. It's a real profession. I would be able to pay the rent. The problem was that it had been nearly 2 months, and there was no job yet, not even the prospect of one. And I was drinking more, going to wine events, meeting with anyone who would talk to me, cracking open 2 or 3 bottles of Pinot Noir at a time. The hand towels in my bathroom were stained purple from the red wine that clung to my lips. When my husband went out without me, friends asked him, "Where's Bianca?" And then, in a hushed voice, "Is she drinking?" Wine people love to talk about wine, I'd assured myself. Show up, demonstrate interest, and ride the Grand Cru Express from there. That was before I knew that Psalms had a name for people like me. I was a civilian, an outsider, a customer, an amateur who didn't know what it was like to count thousands of bottles of wine over the better part of a day in the chill of a cellar, or placate the restaurant owner's fussy friend who set back a $2,000 bottle of 1988 Guigal La Landon for being too weak, which is like complaining a rocket launcher is not explosive enough. Civilians are humored because technically some sommeliers exist to serve them, and the system requires that someone pay the check at the end of the meal. But they are kept at arm's length, and there is a line they cannot cross. These uninitiated amateurs, a class to which I indisputably belonged, are not worthy of admission into the sanctum sanctorum of sommeliers' cellars, tasting groups, and restaurant floors. In short, my initial confidence was completely misguided. While I spoke to many people in the wine world during those first couple of months, the only skill I can say I truly mastered was picking which wine pairs best with a generous serving of humble pie. Answer, any wine. That's approximately where my life stood when I met Joe Campanelli. I felt like a hapless fisherman wearily casting my line out one last time before returning to the shore empty-handed yet again. But with Joe, something funny happened. A bite. Our cellar hand, actually, she just got injured and she won't be able to do the necessary... Joe let his gaze stray to my biceps. "Well, it's a little bit of a physical job," he explained. "Can you lift boxes?" Not really, no, but of course that's not what I told Joe. I wanted to hear more about this cellar hand business. It sounded anachronistic, a little like a chimney sweep or town crier. I quickly learned that cellar hand was the polite title. Around the restaurant, it was called cellar rat. Never mind that. I was desperate. Desperate to break into the industry, desperate to prove to all those who loved me that I was not on the fast track to rehab, and certainly desperate enough to ignore all the warning signs. Now, I would say that, if I remember what I wanted to say, as the name Cellar Rat implies, it was really the lowest of the low in the restaurant industry hierarchy. And rat is a particularly apt term I discovered because I occupied the dankest, darkest corners of the restaurant. I was certainly not to be seen by polite company, and like a rodent infestation, I wreaked havoc on the proper functioning of the restaurant. I lost bottles, I dropped bottles, I disappeared. And yet, I think that it's appropriate that it was, you know, such a... First of all, I had to start somewhere. It was the only way to really begin. And I, you know, in my mind, something switched from solely wanting to write about these cork dorks to, again, wanting to see if I could become one of them. And that meant giving up, well, you know, not just coffee and all liquids above a lukewarm temperature because, you know, for fear of burning your taste buds, but of course daytime sobriety, and also, you know, my job. And I think that it's, you know, particularly appropriate because I realized that with this journey, I wanted to pull back the curtain on parts of the wine world that hadn't been explored. And I should say that this is not a book about fancy men drinking fancy wines in fancy places. I wanted to dive into aspects that we don't often see, right? The high, right? And the low. The soul of wine, but also the science of it. Because truth be told, you know, I was an outsider coming into this world, and I had some doubts. I was very curious to know what about wine was BS and what wasn't. And what I ultimately found is when you clear aside the BS, what remains are these incredible truths that have repercussions far beyond a glass of wine. You know, whether it's how we perceive the world around us or how we remember life's most precious memories. So as part of that, that led me into, as I mentioned, the highs, the Michelin star restaurants, also the you know, mass market wine factories, neuroscientists' labs, as well as these very elite underground tasting groups. Because, you know, in order to learn, I had to taste. And in order to learn to taste, I had to taste with the best. So to give you a sneak peek of that, and I'm going to read another short section. I'd heard whispers about a group of aspiring master sommeliers who flouted these anti-sense sensibilities, which I will say more about shortly, at their weekly meetings at the restaurant 11 Madison Park. Theirs was rumored to be the holy grail of New York blind tasting groups, the highest level in the city. One sommelier warned me there was a waiting list to join. Because it's so cutthroat, she'd been shunned. I'd heard stories of people who were blacklisted for bringing the wrong wine or missing a week without notice. There weren't auditions, applications, or interviews to get in. Instead, like country clubs or Skull and Bones, your best bet was to befriend the right people, work at the right places, and look for occasions, such as competitions, to show you knew your Meursault, a Chardonnay grown in Burgundy's Meursault village, from your Marsannay, a Burgundy grown about 20 miles over in Burgundy's Marsannay village. I asked Victoria James, a wine prodigy who'd recently earned a spot in the group, whether I might be allowed in. "It's very serious," she said, then repeated that two more times. "It's very serious. It's just very serious." She spoke of fights erupting over the typicity of bottles of Chablis. Like, how could you bring this Chablis because 2013 was a warm vintage and obviously it's not showing typically? Blind tasting groups usually segregate along experience level. so I had no business tasting with Master Sommelier candidates. But that's exactly what I intended to do. Blinding, as it's called, with strong tasters enhances the feedback you receive, hence groups' pickiness about admitting new members. I met a woman who'd taken a second job with a 2-hour commute to work for a master sommelier just so she could taste regularly in his presence. Many others fly themselves around the country to do the same. Although I'd been promised introductions to whoever ran the EMP group, weeks had passed, and despite much nagging, nothing had materialized. Morgan, another sommelier who would become my mentor, was a member. I emailed him almost immediately after we left Terroir. Could I come? He was noncommittal at first. I pushed, prodded, and pleaded until finally there came a concession. On a frigid day, when most of the group's 12 or so members were swamped with work emergencies, Morgan relented. I'd have to agree to a compromise, however. I could observe, and I could taste the wines, but given my level, I couldn't speak. Now, I hope that some of you who are at least here with us in person have a little bit of your wine left, because I think now would be a good time. Yes, I see everyone pulling their wines out. I would suggest that you taste as you read, as I read this next section. And just to give you kind of a little bit of background, if you don't know a lot about wine, in general, when you're thinking about doing a blind tasting, first of all, the task is really, so you may know already what you're drinking right now, I don't know, but in general, you're presented with a glass of wine, and based solely on that information contained in the glass, you have, you know, a couple of minutes, usually not more than four, to deduce how the wine was made, what grape it was made from, what year it was made, and where, down to some tiny corner of the planet. You know, not country or region even, but sometimes even a vineyard. That, broadly speaking, can take four phases, if you will. So there's the first, the visual inspection of the wine, so that can have clues about the age, the grape variety. The second phase, which most of us, I think, skip over, is the smell. We kind of think that what we're supposed to do with a glass of wine is drink it. Well, yes and no. There are some wines I find where the pleasure of them is more even in the smell. And so you want to make sure that you take that extra moment. The third part is the taste. So that's kind of, you know, oftentimes that's the part where we talk about the structure of the wine. And the structure of a wine is often used to measure the quality. So if you think of measuring the quality of a book, right? You talk about the plot, the storyline, the dialogue. For a wine, talk about things like the acidity, the alcohol, the tannins, which leave that kind of astringency in your mouth, the sweetness. So two quick tips. If you want to taste the acid in the wine, we're about to get up close and personal. So happy to meet you all today, but I'm going to talk about your saliva. So take a sip of the wine. After you swallow it, take your tip of your tongue, put it against the roof of your mouth, and sort of lean over so your face is parallel to the floor. And if you opened your mouth, think about whether you would drool on yourself. And if you feel like you would drool on yourself, the more you're salivating, the higher the acid in the wine. The less you're salivating, the lower the alcohol. Because that's what we do in response to acid, is we salivate. We're all best friends now. And one other quick tip is the alcohol. People have different methods. For me, I find it's helpful if you take another sip of wine. After you swallow it, exhale and feel how far you sort of feel that burning sensation. You know, are you feeling it just kind of at your jawline? Is it continuing down in your throat? The more you feel that burn, that comes from the alcohol. So the more you feel it, the higher the alcohol of the wine. Think about when you take a shot of tequila, right? You are feeling that burn all the way down into your core. And now imagine that you're doing that to tell not differences between, say, 10% alcohol and 40% alcohol, but 11 and 11.5% alcohol. So you can sip your wine as the Somms sip his. And I think that there's a few names that might come up here, but basically Dana, John, Yannick, and Morgan are all sommeliers for these purposes. So this is the first time that I showed up for this blind tasting group where I was not allowed to speak. I apologized for not having brought wine and offered to bring some next time. No, it's okay. If you did, we'd most likely just whine and yell at you about it like little bitches, said John. It wasn't an empty threat. Blind tasting practice works best when sommeliers train with classic examples of wine. Everything still tastes like toothpaste, John complained as we arranged ourselves around a table in the dining room. Usually brushing my teeth doesn't affect me, but I used a different toothpaste than normal, so I will not be using that one again. I hoped no one would get close enough to smell the minty freshness of the Listerine I'd gargled before leaving home. Brushing my teeth was also beginning to feel like a bad idea. We had 8 wines to go through. Today, we'd be round tabling. Each person would taste 1 wine at a time and, per the format of the Master Sommelier exam, recite their analysis out loud. The others would listen and critique. Okay, I'm counting the ums, Morgan announced. Whites were first, and Dana was up. I want to pause before we dive into that for a public service announcement for our radio listeners. We want to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Sipping, Swirling, and Tasting, Decoding Wine with Bianca Bosker. That's me. Whites were first, and Dana was up. He can do a flight on the nose alone, Morgan boasted. Dana didn't correct him. I picked up my glass and stuck my nose into it. Dana was still inspecting the color, so I took my nose out and examined the liquid. On the spectrum of white or red, this was a white wine. So far, so confident, I thought. Wrong. Pale gold with some rim variation at the meniscus, flecks of gold and green. It's star bright, no signs of gas or sediment, and viscosity is moderate plus, Dana said in a low monotone, speaking as quickly as he could. So white wasn't exactly what he was going for. I sniffed. It smelled, I hated to say it, like wine. You're a writer. You can do better than that, I chided myself. I sniffed harder and lifted the glass closer to my face. Wine dribbled into my nostrils, down my chin, and onto my lap. I dabbed at my face with a page from my notebook. I sniffed again. Maybe one could say apple. Something sweet? Yes, apple and sweet, I decided. A flicker of doubt. Could sweetness be smelled? Dana was already racing ahead. Ripe peaches and peach candy, apricot, Meyer lemon, candied grapefruit, some very liqueur-like fruits, slightly candied tangerine with candied orange peel, getting a slightly Grand Marnier thing going on, honeysuckle, Morgan made a check mark, lily, heavy cream, yogurt, butter, butterscotch, slight hint of tarragon and basil, there's a check, vanilla and baking spice indicating new oak barrique. He hadn't even tasted it yet. Dana took a sip and gargled the wine. He picked up an herb garden and spring bouquet on the palate. There's lilies, Easter lilies, all the types of lilies. He called it dry, with moderate plus acidity and moderate plus alcohol. Dana paused and took a deep breath, crescendoing to his final conclusion. I'm going to call this 2011, Viognier, France, Rhone Valley, Northern Rhone, Condria. Morgan pulled out the bottle and read off the label. It was indeed a Viognier, a floral, richly perfumed grape. It was from France, from the Northern Rhone. Within the Northern Rhone, it was from Condria, an appellation 500 acres in size that is about half as big as Central Park. And it was a 2012. Now, I want to mention, I forgot the fourth part of that analysis, which was the conclusion, which is where you actually, you know, hopefully identify the wine correctly. Now, I will say that when you initially experience that, the skill of blind tasting can seem downright magical. And when I first embarked on this, there was a really open question of my mind of, could I do it? I mean, were these Cork dorks were these aspiring master sommeliers just born more attuned to taste and smell than I was. Was I sort of prisoner to my genes? Because I remember actually talking to another som who worked at some fancy restaurant in Chicago, and he said that when he was growing up, his mom would play a game with him, which is where she would hide a cookie somewhere in his kitchen, and he would have to find it based on smell alone. And I can tell you that at that same age, I was going to school. My mom would like offer me a granola bar when I went to school, and I would say, no, I've got it totally covered, because I had like 3 dog bones in my pocket. And I honestly didn't think that there was a difference. You know, like dog bones, totally delicious. So I was concerned, that this was really a fool's errand. And I will say that, this regime of tasting was also taking a bit of a toll, just to give you a very quick taste of that, no pun intended, just to give you a sense of what was like at this point in time. I was drunk most of the time. I was up to 3, sometimes 4 blind tasting groups a week, which meant I was sober for, on average, a solid 6 hours a day. When I wasn't tasting, I was smelling, trying to rattle off the scents in my shampoo as I showered, but mostly I was tasting. I had a perpetual headache, and I was getting worried about what all this might be doing to my body. "Do you find it's been really hard on your skin?" a friend asked me, her gaze lingering on the puffy areas around my eyes. My dentist gave me a lecture about the dangers of wine's acidity as he poked at my molars. So this was, as I described, this world is really inhabited by masochistic hedonists. And as I was setting out to go from this wine rube to cellarat to sommelier, I had turned my life upside down. I was trying to pass the Court of Master Sommeliers certified sommelier exam, which recommends at least 3 years in the wine industry before you attempt to take it. And I was giving myself a year. So I was willing to put myself through any sort of sacrifice. But I really was curious to know not just what the kind of inherited traditions of the wine world could teach us about training our senses, but critically what science could as well. And so, there was the world of the tasting groups and those tried and true methods that have been passed down through generations of sommeliers. But I wanted to know if I could actually do this. What did science have to say about it? And the answer is, good news, that we can. Any of us, if you've ever learned a word in your life, you have the skills that it takes to develop your sense of smell. But I want to read a little passage. What's interesting is that these are really, for a long time, science actually didn't know a lot about the senses of taste and smell, the chemical senses. And part of that is really, we have Plato and Aristotle to blame for that, because they decided early on that these were the unimportant animalistic senses. This was the wild animal caged up with man. And we've really dismissed them ever since. It's an attitude that's passed over into science, into philosophy, into literature. And that is now changing. There's fascinating, very cutting-edge research that shows that we're better smellers than we think, and I went in search of that in Germany. So I'm going to read a little passage that I think reveals that what most of us think we know about our senses is wrong. I think all you need to know is I was there for a conference, and things got messy. When he's not using them, Martin Witt keeps his brains in a yellow plastic bucket in the basement of a lecture hall on the University of Dresden campus. It could be the company he keeps, but 50-something Martin, an anatomy professor, evokes a skeletal figure himself. Wan complexion, nothing but bones, and skin that stretches tight over his cheeks to reveal a gleaming white grin. He'd brought several specimens, including the brains, with him from his office at the University of Rostock, just north of Dresden, and enjoyed recounting his road trips with this unusual cargo. "I remember I was traveling once between Poland and Germany with 6 fetuses," he said, apropos of nothing, during a cocktail party one evening. He has something less than a surgeon's graceful touch. "We dissected that poor guy. It's really difficult. You need a Black and Decker." And an impressively ample repertoire of jokes about dead bodies. That's a perspective you'll never see in your neighbors unless you dig somewhere. Martin had been invited to present at this conference, which just so happened to coincide with a visit to Thomas's lab, this is the professor, by a class of psychology graduate students. I joined their field trip so I could watch Martin guide them through the human brain, to trace the neurons to the nerves to the brain, and elucidate where one sense ends and the other begins. Martin reached into his yellow bucket to grab a human head that had been sliced in half. "Feel free to touch it," he offered. "If you like, you can have it in your hand."
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
If you're wondering just how misunderstood our chemical senses of taste and smell have been, consider this. It took almost a century, until about the 1970s, to figure out that the tongue map was bogus, a scientific gaffe arising from a mistranslation of a German student's 1901 PhD dissertation. Contrary to the tongue map's teaching, all areas of the tongue are responsive to each of the five tastes. Another common misconception is that the tongue is your body's only taste interpreter. In fact, there are taste receptors on your epiglottis, as well as in your throat, stomach, intestines, pancreas, and if you're a man, your sperm and testes. The idea that humans can perceive only five tastes is also up for debate. Besides sweet, bitter, salty, sour, and umami, scientists have argued for expanding the club of basic tastes to include water, calcium, metallic, soapy, and fat, or oleogustus. Yet even if oleogustus were to take its spot along sweet and sour, the range of taste sensations we perceive pales in comparison to our capacity to discern odors. A paper published in Science posited that humans can detect more than 1 trillion odors. What we consider taste is mostly smell, and it's easy enough to experience it for yourself. This is a good time to bring out that wine glass again. Plug your nose and take a sip of coffee or wine. What you're left feeling is taste. Unplug your nose and the full spectrum of smell and flavor will come rushing back. An espresso tastes bitter, but smells like coffee. So your wine here might taste acidic or sour, but it smells of Chablis, which is what you're drinking. Martin had moved on and was tracing the journey of an aroma on the spongy flesh of his cadaver again. Picture that you're holding a glass of wine, or just hold yours. Just above the surface of the liquid are submicroscopically small scented particles that evaporate from the surface of the wine and become airborne. With each sniff, your nostrils suck in those odorant molecules which travel to the top of your nasal cavity, an air-filled space just behind your nose and eyes. Odors, unlike sound waves, are chemically transmitted. Molecules float off the surface of whatever we smell and into our bodies. Anything you smell, you swallow, is Johann, another neuroscientist's motto. This is a pleasant thought when it comes to fresh roses or some nice black truffles. It is disturbing when you consider the stink of dog shit. By the time you notice its smell, it's too late. The chemicals wafting off the excrement have already made contact with your nasal cavity, where, Johann assured me, they can enter our bloodstream and continue into the brain. Which, he unfortunately felt the need to clarify, means a lot of the shit we smell might end up in the brain. Now, what sent me off on this journey was initially this sensory element, the tasting. But becoming a sommelier means, of course, not just enjoying wine yourself, but leading others to the pleasures of it. And for that, I had to learn the art of service. And I fear that we're running out of time, quickly jump to My experience doing everything in wine, you know, tends to have a sort of fancy French corollary. And so I completed what is referred to in the industry as a stage, which means basically a trail or an apprenticeship at a restaurant. I don't know if you've heard the expression that Manhattan is a playground for the rich. You heard that expression? This is the place that comes to mind when I hear that expression. At 5 p.m., half an hour before the first reservation, I gathered with the rest of the staff for lineup, the daily pre-service meeting. This is a restaurant, I should note, also on a stretch of New York known as Billionaire's Row. The chef introduced a 6-inch half pipe of bone marrow that was new to the menu. A pastry chef recited the petit fours she'd be serving that evening. The maitre d', George, however, was the main event. "We have Octavio Sansone, wine PX at 6:15, he bellowed. "Adesh Patel, a regular guest here. Mr. Bennett Davis, wine PX. Miss Georgina Wild, two people at 6:30, another wine PX. Alex Wang, another wine PX. "PX," Victoria explained, "is short for Personne Extraordinaire, restaurant code for spends dough. It's appended to reservations made by big spenders, owners, friends, high-rolling regulars, and special guests like Chef Daniel Hume of 11 Madison Park, who'd be coming in tonight at 8. They are to be coddled, spoiled, humored, and upsold at all costs. Maria keeps files on its guests, their pet peeves, personal quirks, dining histories, and importance to the restaurant, and communicates the information to the staff via soignés, paper tickets that print as soon as a table is seated so everyone knows how to treat the group. Some restaurants will get no more detailed than VIP, PX, or BLR, short for baller. But the most ambitious dining institutions scrutinize their guests almost as much as the food they send out to the tables. The more someone can or does spend on their meal, the more they're investigated, and they can be flagged as opportunities long before they sit down. A soigné marked ATG means according to Google, as in ATG, investment banking analyst at Barclays Capital. Maria sorts its clientele into niches that include occasional wine PX, wine PX has been, and PPX, personne particulièrement extraordinaire. There is also FO for friend of, FO George, FO owner. You could be a regular, blogger, press, previous complaint. A temper tantrum will get you labeled HWC, handle with care, which is what other restaurants call SOE, sense of entitlement, and the servers call "This motherfucker was crazy last time." Be very, very bad, and you'll be 86, do not accept. Be very, very good, and very profligate, and you just might be crowned, never refuse. I asked Victoria if she ever stereotyped her guests. "Definitely," she said. The minute she lays eyes on a table, she begins sizing them up. Table 46 with the Japanese men. Asian guests usually start a meal with hot water and lemon, so the wine she'll recommend will need to have at least as much acid or it'll taste flat. Table 27 was all men in suits, which hinted at a business dinner. That either meant a $200 cap per bottle or the market's doing well, so they want to spend thousands of dollars. The young couple on the banquette and the couple at the center table were on dates. They'd go for something boring, out of fear of picking the wrong thing. Old money, table 22 and turtlenecks, would want the classics. Table 9 would want to order to show off. They were new money, Victoria said, and would order to impress me. Ultimately, the most important thing was to seize on what the guest wanted from the interaction and deliver that along with the wine. The elderly couple sought an audience to admire their jet-setting lifestyle. Men often craved simple adoration. "Like, it sounds terrible, but men want to be acknowledged," she said. "Stroke their ego a little bit. Great choice. You have a great palate. Congratulations, you have a very big penis. It's a great bottle of wine." Now, a lot of people don't get to see that world, right? This world of these two Michelin star restaurants where you have, you know, $150 side of the shaved white truffle. And as I mentioned before, my desire in this journey was to go beyond the fine dining and the sort of elitism that I think often accompanies coverage of the wine world. And so while my journey did take me into these, you know, very elite and exclusive and rarefied atmospheres, it didn't stop there. And in one instance, what took me sort of beyond that world was this question of wine quality. So in these blind tasting groups, I felt like I was learning to distinguish differences in kind. So a Chenin Blanc from South Africa from a Chenin Blanc from the Loire, let's say. But less so differences in quality. And if you're going to work as a sommelier, you damn well better be able to tell someone why this $200 bottle of wine is that much better than a $20 bottle of wine. And so that led me on this question of, okay, what is a good wine? How do we define quality? And I spoke with economists. I looked at the chemistry of wine. I looked at what critics used to define it. Really turned over every rock I could imagine. And there was no agreement. There seemed to be no ability to reconcile that. So that led me to this. There seemed to be some consensus, however, on what was a bad wine, which led me to this question of, okay, can we define quality in its absence? Which in turn led me to the epicenter of what I think a lot of sort of wine critics would call, you know, quote unquote, bad wine. And I got this rare glimpse at how the bottles that most of us drink most of the time are made. So the average amount that an American will spend on a bottle of wine is somewhere around $9.89. And so, you know, these are not the sort of Domaine de la Romanée Conti that we hear about a lot in glossy magazines and travel, you know, journals, etc. And it turns out that the wines that, you know, a lot of these sort of entry-level mass-market wines are not so much made as they are developed. And before I give you a little bit of a glimpse in that, I'm being told that I should give everyone a reminder and remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Sipping, Swirling, and Tasting, Decoding Wine with Bianca Bosker. Again, still me. So basically, if you think about it, we have this idea that wine is really, the product of grapes, yeast, and love. And they've been made by this artisan, this visionary winemaker who's giving us his vision of the earth. And that's true in some cases, but not in all. And for a lot of these mass market bottles, they're really engineered from the consumer backwards in these focus groups. So people come in, and much like the way that flavor scientists develop the new Doritos flavor or hybrid Swedish fish Oreo, they're essentially run these focus groups where they ask people what they want in a wine, and then they manipulate it to deliver that. So just to give you a small glimpse at all the ways that your wines can be massaged, a very, very quick section. The reality of winemaking in the 21st century is frequently less Little House on the Prairie and more Gattaca. Instead of letting the grapes decide where they want to go, you're manufacturing, you're constructing a wine to meet the palate of the individual winemaker, explained a salesman at the Unified Symposium's American Tartaric Products booth. This is a trade show for winemakers. And it's not really cheating, he volunteered, as if reading my mind. It's creating a better product. There is no fault that can't be corrected with one powder or another. No feature that can't be engineered from a bottle, box, or bag. Wine too thin? Build fullness in the mouth with gum arabic, an ingredient also found in frosting and watercolor paint. Too frothy? Add a few drops of anti-foaming agent, food-grade silicone oil. Cut acidity with potassium carbonate, a white salt, or calcium carbonate, chalk. Crank it up again with a bag of tartaric acid, aka cream of tartar. Increase alcohol by mixing the pressed grape must with sugary grape concentrate. Boost fresh butter and honey aromas by ordering the CY3079 designer yeast from a catalog, or go for cherry cola with the Rhone 2226. Kill microbes with Velcorin, just be careful because it's toxic, and preserve the whole thing with sulfur dioxide. There are more than 60 additives that can legally go into wine. A salesperson manning the BSG booth, where liquid oak extracts were on display, cackled at the notion of bypassing chemical assistance in the winery. "Mother Nature has odd tastes," she warned. "Sure, God will make wine. You just might not like it." So I'm going to open it up for questions in just a moment, but I want to end by saying that I don't know how much you've sort of read the coverage that has accompanied CorkDork's launch this past week. I have, because I get, mentioned and, poked and prodded. And it hasn't been without its fair share of controversy. And I actually, I will say I think there are restaurants where I will now be 86 do not accept. But I also think it's perhaps a sign that there's inherited wisdoms that have worked very well for the wine industry for a long time that are being questioned. I think thoughtfully questioned, but nonetheless questioned. And I think that that's a healthy thing. I think it's a healthy thing for the industry, and I think it's a very healthy thing for drinkers. And just as an example, I wrote a New York Times op-ed that was basically calling attention to the fact that these manipulated wines are manipulated in all of these ways, but also arguing that there was a place for them, that these are, in some cases, they're the welcome that some drinkers need to lead them on the path to becoming thoughtful wine lovers. Because, the wines that a sommelier that's worked for a long time, they might love these delicious aged Barolos, which have a bitterness that doesn't necessarily play well with someone that hasn't spent a lot of time drinking wine. And this has caused a firestorm in the wine industry. I've received no shortage of really wonderful letters from winemakers, from drinkers, from distributors, people that thought it was a really brave piece, that it shed light in a way that it needed to on what's happening in the industry. And on the other extreme, I have received threats. I had a woman tell me, who stalked me at a wine bar who I've never met before in my life, who took a photo of me, posted it on Facebook, and told me I was a piece of shit who should watch out if she ever sees me again on the street. I was told by someone that he had a seizure reading my story and that I was the reason that Trump got elected, which feels like a bit of a stretch. And I think that what concerns me is that too often the wine elite prefers to tell people what to taste. And my hope with CorkDork is to really give people the ability to taste themselves and decide what is it. How do you get in touch with your own tastes? How do you figure out what tastes good to you? Because that is, I think, the foundation for a much more productive relationship and lasting relationship with wine. And I did have this kind of realization along the way that I think a lot of us settle for secondhand sensing, right? We let prices and labels and menu descriptions tell us what's delicious, which is ironic because in this midst of this foodie culture, I mean, we're at the heart of it here in San Francisco. We obsess and spend all this money on finding food that tastes better without actually teaching ourselves to taste well. And in the course of my training, learning to blind taste is about this physical development and training. But more than that, even, it's this mental exercise. It's one that forces you to clear away your biases and really hone in, not how expensive it was, not, your doubts, oh, you missed Chardonnay last time, is it Chardonnay, you'll never know, but to clear away the ego, to clear away those doubts and stay true to this own honest felt experience. And we've all heard of mindfulness. We are, in San Francisco. I know that you know that term. But at the end of this, I came to value this other mindset that I would describe as sensefulness, which is this idea that it's by tuning into our senses that we learn to make sense of the world. And with that, I would like to open it up for Q&A and remind you to please use the microphones at the back of the room. Thank you. And if you don't have any questions, oh, you're supposed to go in the back. I'm sorry.
Thanks so much. I really enjoyed your talk. Hi. And I was just wondering how this changed your own, like your personal choices in terms of how you use and consume and purchase wine yourself in your own, you know, day-to-day life.
So that's a great question. I will say that I have both... I definitely am spending and buying a lot more wine than I used to, but I will say that with this knowledge of wine comes the ability to find amazing hidden gems. So I think I have a much better appreciation for how to hunt out and root out those delicious, underappreciated, you know, white grillos from Sicily that are not those kind of gimme wines that everyone recognizes and orders and asks for. At the same time, I think that I have become a little bit of a liability in the sense that I have developed a fiscally unsound appreciation for aged white wines in particular. But I do think that there's, to me... You know, at the beginning, the only thing I ever got out of a glass of wine was a little buzz. And now I am capable of seeing the stories in a glass of wine. And those stories can exist in a cheap bottle. They may not be that interesting, but it has something. To me, there's still something there. It tells me something about the additives, the mega purple that may have gone in there. But the best wines are those that really do have that more interesting, complicated story. So... I think that it's, I don't know, I think it's just, it's a richer experience, and that can happen in a less expensive bottle, and it can be even better in a more expensive bottle, but not always. Please.
Thanks, Bianca. So I'm particularly curious about this question of aging wines. How do wine experts know that a particular year is ageable, and why do some wines turn to vinegar and others... improve with age? What's the mystery of the aging?
That is such a great question. So I think that there's this, to some extent, it's pattern and it's experience, right? If you're working in Bordeaux and you've had the benefit of tasting wines over generations, right, and seeing how they evolve, you have a better sense for sort of what you're looking for at the outset. But, you know, I think, and there's some things that we know sort of more scientifically and more definitively. For example, acid is something that helps a wine sort of stand up to the test of time, which is why some of these incredible, some of the most valuable wines in the world are these... you know, aged whites that have this high level of acidity that really, it's sort of like the backbone that lasts for a long time. But I think that there is just an element of guesswork involved at the same time. I mean, and there's these wines can be so fickle, right? The way that a wine ages can have not only influenced by what happened in the vineyard 20, 30, 40 years before, but, you know, how it was stored, at what temperature, what little bit of bacteria may or may not have gotten into the cork. So I think that there's always, you know, when you're opening some of these older wines, it's a terrifying experience. and I think that I would encourage people, though, because I do think when I started out, I also had this question, though, of like, what is special about, like, why would you want to drink this old wine? I mean, is it really that much better? And the answer is not necessarily better, but it's different and it is more rare. And that tastes delicious, right? Flavor is the combination of taste and smell, but also our expectations, the price we paid for the wine, the color of the room we're drinking it in. And so there is something precious and so delicious about a wine that we know there are very few bottles of, that we got to relish this, you know, one of a few dozen maybe that are left in the world. But I would encourage you, you know, you don't have to pay a lot of money for old wine. So I would encourage people as you're going out to drink, you know, maybe pick a wine, pick your budget, and then look and see what on the wine list is more than 10 or 20 or 30 years old and fits your budget. You will be oftentimes surprised. And they're just different flavors that develop and emerge and mature in the same way that humans age and develop and mature. Please.
Hi, welcome home.
Thanks.
Back to San Fran. Quick question. Where do you see a possible intersection between technology and wine? Maybe in this, like, debunking the elitist or recreating these one of only 12 bottles in the world?
That's a great question. So I think that there's certainly been interesting, there have been attempts to combine those two elements together. So for example, there's wine apps that you can use to take a photo, they actually work incredibly well, to take a photo of the label as you're drinking it. And they're sort of, they kind of function like Instagram for wine. So if you're really into wine, it's a fun place to go to see what everyone else is drinking and sharing and posting. But they essentially records the label. And I find that to actually be an incredibly helpful tool, because one of the biggest problems that I think keeps people from developing a love for wine is they're just not paying attention, right? If you don't know, how are you going to know that you like or dislike Sauvignon Blanc if you didn't realize that you've been drinking it these last, you know, four or five times? But I think, you know, I am very fascinated by these attempts to, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but to essentially replicate the best and rarest wines using no grapes whatsoever, essentially through a sort of composite of, as I understand it, chemicals and, you know, aromatic elements and essences. And I think the proof will be in the bottle, ultimately. Any more? Be good? Wonderful. Well, I will be around signing books. We have more wine for you to drink, so you can now experiment with everything that you've learned. And, you know, drool on each other and enjoy some great wine. And I'll be signing. We can talk more. Thank you so much.
A very big thank you to Bianca Bosker, author of Cork Dork, a wine-fueled adventure among the obsessive sommeliers, big bottle hunters, and rogue scientists who taught me to live for taste. I'd also like to thank our audiences here and also our listening audience. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.